This is day 5 of this January 2013 Rohatsu 7-day session. And I'll take one more day with the Chinese Zen master Zibo from the 16th century. Before returning to our text, a word about chanting, and in particular, what we call, for lack of a better word, our dark chanting that we do late in Sesshin. Chanting is a way to experience no-mindedness. It is a In that sense, it's like other elements of Sesshin, like besides Zazen, of course, the work period, the exercise period. It's another way to get beyond words and thoughts during chanting. But, of course, we do use words in chanting, which isn't a problem, except when we're reading from the book. If we have to follow the text, it's still not much of a problem, but it's a little, when we're reading, we slightly engage the discursive mind, the discriminating mind. You'll notice this if you try reading right after Sesshin, right after you come out of a 7-day Sesshin, that there's almost a visceral sense of sort of stimulating the discriminating mind. But until we memorize these chants, then we have to follow along. We all do follow along in the booklet. But what we've done is just to have people be able to leave aside their books a little bit and experience that during Sesshin. We've done this the last, after the middle of Sesshin, where we chant just the two shortest chants, the Kanongyo and the Shosamyo Kichijo Dorani, in hopes that most people would be able then to participate in the chanting of those two without needing the books. The important thing is participating. We never want to be observers, whether it's chanting or anything else. We want to engage. And then, since we don't have books, no one has to worry about reading from the books, then we can also dim the lights, which also, I think, makes it a little easier to reach this no-mindedness. All right, now back to our man Zibo. This is from a book called Zibo. That's the title. The Last Great Zen Master of China, translated by J.C. Cleary. And it starts off, you know, I've made the mistake of referring to some of these as talks. These are letters. So in a letter to a Ma Xin Fu, he says, if there is actually no self when you sleep without dreaming, who controls the breathing? If you think there is a self, where is it? Without knowing how, you dream. Suddenly, you don't know where you are. N- if there is actually no self when you sleep without dreaming. Well, let's establish first that what we call the self is just an aggregate of thought forms. It's a kind of a collection of memories and associations and images of oneself that we have accumulated during our lifetime. But there is no, really there's no person there. It's just this collection of mind stuff, thoughts, basically, that gives the appearance of being a discrete entity. Because there is a certain continuity in our personality and as well as in our body, this also contributes to the illusion that we are in some, there is some little man inside us or a little woman inside us. There's some self. But this is the fundamental illusion. So when we are asleep but without dreaming, then there are no thought forms or images. And that's where he's suggesting, if there is actually no self when you sleep without dreaming, who controls the breathing? Yeah, this is a great question, especially for people who are doing breath practice, who may misunderstand that they're supposed to be controlling the breath. Or even more subtly, just thinking, I am breathing. But one could just as accurately say, you're being breathed, as evidenced by the fact that we sleep all night, we're unconscious, and that breath just fills the lungs and is expelled, and fills the lungs and is expelled all night long without any conscious control on our part. This is where the illusion of the I creates another illusion, the illusion of the I as an agent that's doing something. When we really get absorbed in the breath, this notion of a self controlling things starts to break down. We see we don't have to be asleep. We can be doing zazen and come to discover that, yes, we're being breathed. To even say, my body is my body, is misleading. If it's mine, implying control, then why can't we control the breath? Well, we can to some degree, but it just has a mind of its own, this breath, as well as the blood circulating through our body and other basic bodily functions that just do fine without our controlling them or even understanding them. And then that second sentence, if you think there's a self, where is it? Well, most people would just point to their body and it's right here. But that too, as we just said, the body itself is just a certain congealed energy. The body itself is energy in flux. There's a wonderful little story, parable, that I've read before in Taisho, but not in a while. It's about a little doll made of salt. And this little salt doll went on a very, very long journey over dry land, let's say, through the desert, when she finally arrived at the seashore. This little salt doll had never seen the sea before, and she didn't have a clue what it was. So she addressed it. She said, "What are you?" And the sea replied, "I am me." And the doll said, "I don't understand, but I do want to understand." So the sea said, "Touch me." And so the little doll ventured cautiously to put her toes in the water and then quickly pulled them out and was shocked to see that they had vanished. "But where have my toes gone?" she asked. The sea quietly replied, "You have given something in order to understand." It was something about the tone of the voice of the sea that was reassuring, and the doll somehow trusted what the sea was saying, and so she went back and ventured a little further into the water, and then farther, and at each step, losing more of herself, disappearing more and more. Finally, a big wave engulfed her, and as the last of her completely vanished, she said, "Now I know what the sea is. The sea is me." Dreaming. For years and years, I've heard from students who report having disturbing dreams during Sesshin, during and right after Sesshin. And this has never been a surprise to me, because I used to also. It's not terribly unusual during Sesshin and right after to have violent, horrific, and even depraved dreams. This can be very unsettling, of course. I remember the first one or two times it happened to me, I thought, what kind of person am I that I would be having these kinds of dreams? Well, of course, there's no person there. We don't have to draw conclusions about the nature of one's character based on dreams. Sesshin opens the mind. It pries open the mind, and we are exposed, we become aware of stuff, deep levels of the mind and the unconscious that we're not familiar with, that we never thought of as ourself. But there's no need to be concerned about this. It's what it is. It's just a cleansing. It's like a house cleaning of the mind. These what can be disturbing grotesque kind of dreams. This is just flushing out old stuff in the mind. It's really a positive thing to get this out. Out of the what's called the storehouse consciousness in Buddhism, Buddhist psychology posits this deep level of the mind where all of our sense experiences are deposited in seed form. So everything we've seen, everything we've heard, everything we've smelled, everything we've touched, everything we've tasted, and everything we've thought about, according to this Buddhist psychology, is dumped, basically, in this storehouse consciousness, the alaya vijnana. And it lies there, all these seeds lie there in dormant form until secondary causes and conditions stimulate them and there they sprout, they come into consciousness. Well, sesshin is one of those causes, or zazen in general, but it's most likely when we're doing 10 or more hours of sitting a day, this is when we're most likely to excavate stuff in the mind that we didn't know was there. It's really sobering. It's sobering to see some of this stuff and realize that, well, this can't be proven, but it's not hard to conclude that there's a lot more where that came from, and that we, depending on what we expose ourselves to in all kinds of ways, that will determine what is latent in the mind, at the deepest level of the mind. It's sobering because we have to acknowledge that what we expose ourselves to counts. This matters. Anyone who can accept this process would have to ask herself or himself why you would want to see a movie with graphic violence or expose yourself to pornography, much less certain terrible kinds of pornography. Do you think this is just passing through the mind and going off nowhere? But when this stuff does reveal itself in sesshin or anywhere, the important thing is not to come up with dark hypotheses about the nature of one's character. It is just a cleansing process. The important thing is not to waste any time analyzing it or thinking about it in any way. This doesn't help a bit. You can just gulp and shudder maybe at what's coming up, and then just get back to the practice. It exhausts itself. At least it did for me. I can't speak for others, but eventually, I don't know. Exhaust sounds absolute, like if it's all gone. But it certainly decreases. It has to decrease a lot through this incredible process of purification that we call zazen. He continues, you must thoroughly shut off the myriad entangling causes. One moment, 10,000 years, 10,000 years, one moment. Find out where you are. Only then can you discuss this matter properly. Find out where you are, meaning find out what you are, who you are. Prove, confirm that this true self is no self. He continues, if you come when your enthusiasm is high and leave when your enthusiasm runs out and want to judge this matter with your thinking mind, though you may understand a little, all in all, it's like casting a net at the wind, vain exertion that catches nothing. Well, yeah, the inconstancy of enthusiasm, if we rely on enthusiasm, we won't go very far. The spiritual journey is one with full of pitfalls and swamps of confusion and discouragement and all kinds of things, and it can get very dry. It's like that desert where that salt doll was wandering. And this is where faith, we have to call on faith to just keep going when we don't see much in the way of results. This is where, as I said earlier, where we have to trust the process. Trust it. Trust that if you continue doing this long enough, that you get through this stuff. They just, these obstructions, these stalled out periods, just don't, aren't a problem if, when you become more experienced. You just recognize them as just dark threads in a vast tapestry of practice. Years or decades or lifetimes. You must be mindful that old age and sickness do not give us a fixed amount of time. Time should not be frivolously wasted. When you gain success and fame, it is no different from wearing a garland of flowers in a dream. When you lose success and fame, it is no different than the flowers which you wear in the dream being blown down by the wind. Moved by the vanishing of the flowers, you awaken. Upon awakening, you think back on wearing the garland of flowers in the dream. The flowers in the dream vanish. When you awaken, who was wearing them? What vanished? Who is it who wakes up and knows of the flowers and the vanishing? Thus you come to investigate this. Before the self is there, where does the self suddenly come from? Once the self is there, it cannot turn things around, but in the end is turned around by them. Meaning this to the degree that we believe in an ego self. Ultimately, where is the root of this sickness? If you can find out the root of the sickness, then everything is all right. Wearing flowers, flowers vanishing, vain thoughts with eyes open, dreaming with eyes closed, not dreaming with eyes closed. This seems to be one of his favorite themes, Zeebo, is warning his students of the ephemeral nature of success and fame. There's a story I have to read. This is from the book Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World. The rich industrialist from the north was horrified to find the southern fisherman lying lazily beside his boat smoking a pipe. "Why aren't you out fishing?" said the industrialist. "Because I've caught enough fish for the day," said the fisherman. "Well, why don't you catch some more?" "What would I do with it?" "Well, you could earn more money. With that, you could have a motor fixed to your boat to go into deeper waters and catch more fish." "Then you would make enough money to buy nylon nets. These would bring you more fish and more money. Soon you would have enough money to own two boats, maybe even a fleet of boats. Then you would be a rich man like me." "What would I do then?" "Then you could really enjoy life." "What do you think I'm doing right now?" he said. I once saw some graffiti on a wall in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that has stuck with me ever since. In big, scrawled, painted letters, it said, "Work, buy, consume, die." Next letter, the translator gives it the title, "A Swindle." Zeebo: "Men do not know how to make themselves important and make themselves great. Thus there are no lengths of evil they won't go to. Since they do not make themselves important, things become important, and their own state of being becomes unimportant. Since they do not make themselves great, things become great, and their own selves become minor. Thus they lose their importance and greatness and accept instead the trivial and the minor without refusing them. All inherently possess the full measure of this importance and this greatness, no matter whether old or young, worthy or foolish. It is just that they are swindled and led astray by insignificant reputation and petty profit, superficial glory and insubstantial social status. The fundamental light of each and every person shines through past, present, and future." Well, he's just sounding a very basic Buddhist theme that so long as we have not seen into our fundamental self-sufficiency, so long as we have not seen that we are the world is us, there's nothing outside us, then we can waste our lives grasping at things which become unimportant or less important as we come to mine the riches of this true self that is no self. And it is the mind, of course, that is the swindler, that creates this ego delusion of this separate self. That's the pathos of believing in a separate self, is it can never be big enough. And so it can never have enough. No matter how much it gets, it will want more. It will still always feel incomplete because of the illusion of separateness, of two-ness. No matter how much we expand it in our mind, no matter how big a person we become, you know, it's not as big as the world, it's not as big as the universe. Of course, it is the universe. We are, each one of us. The next letter, the mind light is originally profoundly clear. Making things subtly wondrous, it has no entanglements. Making things subtly wondrous, this is just what happens naturally through a lot of zazen, that we see things with fresh eyes and they become wondrous to one degree or another. Anyone can have this experience, even just briefly during sesshin. I come out of the zendo for a break period, and we see things differently. And what had always been before, just a cup, or just snow on the ground. Just snow on the ground. Okay. Or just some clouds in the air, blah, 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 then become something very different. This is the great, great gift of sesshin, which is just another way of saying the great gift of zazen, is that it changes our perspective. We see things differently. We see people differently. What could be more fundamental? What could be more valuable than to be given a fresh perspective on our life? What houses or boats or anything can compare with that? Well, this is something that surely everyone knows, anyone who comes to sesshin. It's what brings us back again and again and again. He goes on, arbitrarily producing knowledge and views, people lose that pure illumination. Thus the eye consciousness sticks to form, the ear consciousness sticks to sound, the nose consciousness sticks to smell, the tongue consciousness sticks to flavor, the body consciousness sticks to touch, and the conceptual mind's consciousness sticks to phenomena. They run after objects and flow out, forever forgetting to return. Of course, he's talking about attachment. Becoming attached to sights, attached to smells and tastes and so forth. There's no Buddhist master has ever had any issue with the senses themselves. It's our attachment to them. You don't have to block out the senses, the sounds and sights and tastes and so forth. But we so easily become attached to these things. That's the danger of the senses. In themselves, in and of themselves, there's nothing wrong with them, of course. It's a marvelous functioning of sentient beings to have these senses. And for with human beings, the higher consciousness, the discriminating mind. These are, to say they're useful is utter understatement. But then we so easily turn them into things that bedevil us, that snare us in suffering. And so the example, the obvious example, is during sesshin, where we have people keep their eyes down. Okay, there's nothing wrong with sights. Okay, right, agreed. But how many people can be looking around and not then get caught up in thoughts? And what's wrong with thoughts? Well, thoughts take us away from this present moment. The only thing that's real is this. He goes on, little do they know that the first five consciousnesses, those are the five senses, ordinary senses, are a single awareness. Only the sixth, that's the thinking, sets knowledge blazing up. If the sixth does not flare up, then what fault is there in that awareness of the first five senses? Thus it is said, first we dwell in perfect immediate awareness before the floating dusts arise. Later we fall onto the ground of the conceptual faculties, quote, clear understanding, and external shapes form beneath the surface. Thus perfect awareness becomes defective. Let's just break that down. Thus it is said, first we dwell in perfect immediate awareness. This is what use a Japanese word, this is what's called the first nen. N-E-N. The first nen is the pure, direct awareness of, let's say, the sound. Sound of someone coughing. There. That's just the immediate awareness. But then, for most people, then something piggybacks on that. Some thought. Some association. That's the second nen. And then all within the period of about a hundredth of a second, there's a third and a fourth and a fifth and a sixth nen, and it's called a train of thought. We're off and running, and we've lost the present awareness. Now we're not hearing sounds anymore because we're in our thoughts. Even thoughts themselves, if we leave them alone, never advance beyond the first nen. There's just the immediate awareness of a thought. That's not going to cause any problems. It's then building on them where we are taken away from ourselves. First we dwell in perfect immediate awareness before the floating dusts arise. When I read this, I couldn't help but talk about an association. You know those we had these when we were kids. They're like you buy them at toy stores. They're like they're shaped like an eight ball, and it's like for fortune reading. So they have these little sayings on little fragments inside. So you turn the eight ball. And you ask it a question, you know, will I be rich? And then you wait, and then one of them floats up. Remains to be seen. Or you can count on it. Or I couldn't be the only one in this room who's seen those things. My sisters used to have a great time with them. This is what the mind is like in Zazen, isn't it? It's just these little things floating up. Words, phrases, images, pieces of songs. This is, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, is just this this excavation, this opening the mind and having all this stuff come up. And it doesn't need to be a problem as long as we just leave all that stuff alone. And he says, only if you can awaken to this submerged arising of forms, and in the arena of adverse and favorable circumstances and right and wrong and glory and disgrace, thoroughly extend yourself to contemplate lucidly all gain and loss as clouds touching rock, as wind moving across the treetops. Only then can you live up to being a human being and be a model of leaving home. Leaving home, he's referring to the monks, his monks, home leavers. If you spurn this responsibility, dying is better than living. When you complete the embodiment of it, then the defective one becomes perfect, and even shitting and pissing are Buddhist acts, not just burning incense. To see all gain and loss as clouds touching the rock. What happens to clouds when it touches rock? As wind moving across the treetops. Without substance. All these ideas that we traffic in during Sesshin. One's my practice compared to others' practice. My progress or my lack of progress. It's all just wind moving across the treetops. Nothing we want to get involved in the least. But it's not easy. It's hard not to get involved in these habitual thoughts of oneself, the I, the me, and the my. It's very difficult not to get caught in these things. But with the practice that we're working on, we have every chance of leaving those things alone. But it takes effort. It takes single-minded effort to keep the mind on the breath or the koan. And then when we lose it, bring it back. Bring it back. Never lose heart. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.